Welcome back, friends and listeners. If you are an enthusiast dedicated to reality and who want to know the real story and see through the spin and conditioning in the media, in education and academia, you have come to the right place. This is Red Eyes Radio, an independent, intrepid, investigative radio program and news website that is seeking answers to understand and to learn and, of course, to counter the spin being used against you. I'm Henrik Palmgren from the west coast of Sweden, Scandinavia. Thank you for tuning in. It is great to have you here. We have a couple of sites for you where you can get our regular updates, new radio shows, news, and more. RedEyesCreations.com, RedEyesMembers.com, and also check out RedEyesRadio.net. Our guest today is writer Richard Doland. He is considered by many students of the UFO phenomenon to be the preeminent historian of the subject. He is the author of UFOs and the National Security State, as well as an analysis of the future, AD After Disclosure. But today we're going to talk about his latest one that is called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. Among Richard's main themes are the destruction of our political liberties as the result of the UFO cover-up, the possible nature of the non-humans themselves, and what their presence here means for our civilization. This has led him to take a fresh approach to the topic of exopolitics and to develop a unique insight into the practical challenges and opportunities for a true disclosure of the UFO phenomenon. Richard, born in Brooklyn, New York, studied at Alfred University and Oxford University, was a finalist for a Rhodes Scholarship, and completed his graduate work in history at the University of Rochester. Prior to his interest in UFOs, he studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history and culture, and international diplomacy. In this program, we'll continue to discuss the concept of a breakaway civilization and the secret space program leading up to the conference here later in June. Later in the second hour, we'll discuss the New Age connection as related to the UFO field as well. Good stuff coming up. And welcome back, Richard. Great having you back once again. Thank you for being here. I know you're out on the road right now, so you're very busy. So thanks for taking a little bit of time off talking with us today.
Henrik, it's my pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you very much. We'll obviously going to discuss more on the Secret Space Program conference here, the upcoming, I'd say the premier event of this year, at least. I mean, we're going to talk more about that later. We just have a couple of weeks away now, so it's approaching fast, as it were. But you've also written a new book in the meantime, you know, since we last spoke with you, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. And there are some very intriguing new concepts that you address in the book that I really want to get deeper into detail about in this interview as well. But give us an outline of the book first, Richard.
By all means. The book actually came out as a result of a request a few years ago to create an online university program for the subject of UFOs. And I decided I would take it. I was given free range as to how to set it up, how to put it together. I did that, and I realized that really what I wanted to do was turn this whole thing into a book. So, and that's the result. It's UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. I guess I could call it my attempt to reconceive of the entire subject of UFOs in as fresh a way as I could. That includes the history, philosophical implications of understanding what UFOs are, the politics, including the deep politics of the cover-up and how things really are structured. And lots more social aspects of this phenomenon, the whole issue of contact slash abduction slash whatever is going on between us and them, looking at some of the very strange scientific aspects of this phenomenon as well, and then looking forward at the future disclosure, if that happens, and what might happen after that. So really, all of the things that I've considered important relating to the subject of UFOs and making it in as relevant a manner as I could for people of the 21st century, not something that reads like 1985, you know.
Is that the primary incentive why you feel that the subject needs to be refreshed, you know, reviewed and updated, or is there something more behind that?
Well, there really isn't, in my view, a good, or there hasn't been a sufficient or adequate overview of the whole subject. I mean, you think of something as massive and profound as a UFO subject and all of its multifaceted aspects of the phenomenon. It just hadn't existed, at least not in the last 20 years or more, and I think it was long overdue. We've, in the last generation, we've moved into a completely new era. It's post 9/11, so much of the world has been sort of politically radicalized. We've, I think, learned a lot more. We're continuing to learn a lot more about this very strange phenomenon, and I think it was time to do a fresh look at the whole picture.
Very good. Now, tell us a little bit how this field plays into, as you see it, part of the deeper, you know, political, you know, geopolitical structure. There is the idea, of course, of cover up and the consequent potentiality of this field being released and opened up, and ergo we might have things completely changing on the energy level of things. How is the interplay between the UFO world and everything else that's happening right now in the geopolitical scene, in your view?
Right. Well, I might start by just saying, when you look at all of the subjects that we consider the alternative research community, whether it's geoengineering or 9/11 studies or underground bases or Illuminati or what have you, the UFO subject is in that mix. But I've often found that it doesn't get quite the love or respect or attention that I feel it deserves, or many other people feel it deserves. And part of it, I think, is that a lot of alternative community researchers are still afraid of it. They're still afraid to look at UFOs and to consider that this is part of the mix. I think, honestly, it's generations of ridicule. It's generations of kind of in the box thinking that has prevented many people from stepping out and really seeing this for what it is, which is a fundamental, integral part of the world we live in. And it's something that I think is well overdue for us to truly grasp and to bring into the mainstream of our understanding. I guess I could back up and just say, I think that the UFO phenomenon is arguably at the heart of what I like to call black budget America. I think it's at the heart of the creation of the kind of domination of my country in special access programs, black budget programs that are not answerable to Congress. It's not the only instigator of black budget America or black budget world, but it is a key instigator of that. Go back to the 1940s. I try to rewind the clock when I think this through and look at the situation that President Harry Truman probably encountered when this phenomenon was dropped into his lap, so to speak. You have a situation where probably his top generals or top science advisor, maybe Vannevar Bush or General George Marshall, approached the president and said, listen, we not only have evidence, strong evidence, that there is the presence of this other that is here on planet Earth, but we've recovered some of their technology, which I think is what happened. And if that is the case, then you've got a situation of, it's a radical situation right there. You've got to make an instant decision. Do we tell the world or not? And it's clear to me that he would not feel that he could tell the world. You tell the world you've got exotic technology, it becomes very difficult not to share it. And in the context of the late 1940s, that's a very important thing. I mean, the United States had a monopoly of atomic weapons at that time, and they certainly did not want to share that. I can't see any reason why they would want to share something as exotic as alien technology if that's what they had.
Right.
So you create a program to study this in secret. You create a program to fund the research secretly, and you have to do that around congressional knowledge. You can't let members of Congress know. So intrinsically, it creates a system that is extra constitutional, beyond the Constitution. And that's what gets it started. You start the secrecy. And as all really good secrets, it becomes very difficult to reveal it, because it develops its own power, its own momentum, its own bureaucracy, its own profitability. And we're now a whole human lifetime later, and this secret has transmuted and transformed. And I mean, it's astonishing when I think about how profound and how widespread it has become. And I ask myself every day, what is the true structure of that secrecy today? It's one of the things that keeps me going.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's one of the big questions. I mean, what would you say, what kind of levels of transformation has this gone through? Do you think that the motives are very much different today? I mean, I guess that depends completely on what has been learned along the way. Of course, what has been developed, but also potentialities of, contacts and interaction with off-world entities, etc. This could have taken any shape that we can imagine. Where do you think it's developed to?
Well, I think what happened initially is a simple political decision to study this phenomenon. If I were the president, I would have my people around me, and I would say, your job will be to have this technology studied and find out what we can learn about it. And your job will be to find out who the hell these other beings are, what they are. Do I have anything to worry about, and so forth? Are they friends, foes, and or whatever? Another person's job would be to manage the media, to make sure that everyone is on board and that all of the you know, important questions are not asked in the public domain. Academic control, same kind of control over the academic community, the political community, and all of that. So you get your pieces in place. What I think happens is that, particularly if you're studying the technology, which presumably would be vastly, vastly beyond anything that humans had at that time, it's not that people would be able to duplicate the intricacies of alien technology, but I do think that studying it would probably give some very, very good ideas for innovation down the road during the 1950s and 60s. And those are money makers, whether that means the development of integrated circuits, whether that means fiber optics and anything beyond that. So you've got a money-making system in place now. And it seems to me that the secret becomes increasingly privatized over the years. One doesn't only see this in the UFO field. One sees this everywhere. I think when we look at political power, we increasingly understand that the power, the real power, is financial, which stands behind the scenes. We've really gone through a kind of silent, or maybe not so silent, transnational revolution in the last couple of generations, in which, you know, I think many, many thoughtful people are wondering what is the actual breakdown of power here on planet Earth. It's not necessarily just good old fashioned nation states anymore. There's something much greater than that. We're in a global society that is dominated by very, very small number of financial elites who really run the show. And I think the same thing has happened within the UFO cover up, the UFO field, so that within the American structure of special access programs, black budget programs, the research that we've gotten out of it so far is that those two have become much more dominated by private interests rather than standard U.S. government, Defense Department personnel. So the secret's transmuted over the years, and it's gone farther and farther away from public oversight.
Well, exactly. The question I've always had as well is if this particular field is actually dictating, shall we call it, surface politics, like the decisions that we see in the world, some of the big, you know, movements, what is happening, or is this a field, I'm talking about, like, the, you know, the black budgets, the secrecy operations and everything, is if this operates underneath or outside the realm of what we could call regular political affairs? What do you think?
Yes, I think very much the latter. I had a conversation on a number of occasions with a very, very prominent individual who was with CIA for quite a long time. This is a man who had given briefings to at least one American president on a number of occasions. Brilliant man. Anytime I ask him a question, he qualifies his answer five or six ways before he gives me an actual, you know, precise answer. And on one occasion, I asked him the question that I think a lot of researchers probably would like to know is, how much do American presidents know about the UFO phenomenon?
Mm-hmm.
And his answer was very, very instructive to me. This is a man who told me that he had conversations, one-on-one conversations, with 18 former U.S. presidents, CIA directors, and Defense Department chiefs. So 18 of those guys. So he's on a first-name basis with all of them. And said to me that he had spoken one-on-one with those individuals about the subject of UFO/ET, which I thought, wow, there's a great, who would not want to be a fly on the wall of those conversations? And he said to me that the answers broke down into three fundamental groups. On one end of the spectrum, a very small number, like three or four of those people said, UFOs, what is wrong with you? Why are you wasting your time with such a stupid topic? Don't waste my time with it. On the opposite end of the spectrum, I think he said two or three answered, yes, I know about that. I've been briefed on it. Maybe we can share a little bit of information. And by far the largest group, by far, were those who said, oh, I'm very interested in that. I have tried to get information about that, and I have basically failed. And what do you know? What can you tell me about it? The implication being that these are individuals at the very, very top of what is supposed to be the formal structure of power in the United States, and yet all but a very few of them seem to have been read into this program in which they had any kind of significant information. And when I asked him, you know, further, well, what do you think this means? Does this mean that there's a control group behind something like, you know, related to the Bilderberg or some other power behind that? His answer was, yes, that's exactly what I think.
Yeah.
So the formal structure of power has become increasingly irrelevant. There have been a few leaks along the way that have indicated this is so. There was a statement that came through Ben Rich, who was a former head of Lockheed's Skunk Works division, which is very, very prominent. And according to what Rich told one colleague, his predecessor, Kelly Johnson, who was a legend and the developer of the U-2 aircraft, had said that control, formalized control over managing the UFO secret, explicitly moved away from the United States president around 1969 to an international group. And that would have been at the beginning of the administration of Richard Nixon. And that all fits. I think what we're talking about then is a global structure of power that's become very much internationalized, as well as management over the ultimate UFO secret. Whatever is contained within that has moved out of the formal structure of power in the U.S. And along those lines, I'll just mention another story that I got, and I know the whole source of this, and I consider this exceptionally reliable, having to do with former President Jimmy Carter. This is something that I indicated in, I think, in my last two books, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind and also AD After Disclosure. And it has to do with a briefing that Jimmy Carter received in June of 1977. He was a very new president at the time. And the briefing did concern the UFO ET situation. And this gentleman, this former CIA gentleman that I spoke to, said to me that he did not know exactly what Jimmy Carter was told, but that he did know that at the conclusion of that meeting, Carter was seen at his desk with his elbows on the desk, his head in his hands, and he was sobbing, or he was deeply upset. So something was told to him that clearly he didn't want to hear. My guess would be that one of the things he was told is, sir, this is a very serious problem and you have no operational control over it. And, you know, one gets these hints over and over again. I have another source that told me about a gentleman who was in the first Reagan administration, early 1980s. He was an undersecretary, high-level position. And that before he took his position, he was given a two-week briefing underground in some underground facility. One evening, after a couple of too many drinks, he told a friend of the family about this briefing, and that it had to do in large part with the UFOs. And all he would say was that it was so deeply upsetting, and the main thing that upset him was that he had a daughter to raise in this world. And it apparently really transformed his thinking. So, it's an incredible story, and I believe it. It's stories like this, it's accounts like this that leak out, that come out, and to me, researchers like myself and others, that again caused me to think that this is a deeply serious topic. It is so stressful. It is so traumatic for some people that they honestly do not know how to talk about it. And you know, one gets the sense that they're constrained from talking about it publicly. So it's a big thing. And it's when one looks at all of the other awful criminal things going on in the world around us, there is this huge elephant in the dining room, elephant in the yard, that is there. And I firmly believe is an important presence in our world and has a relationship to many of these other things that we're seeing. And yet it's you know, taboo to talk about it in a public forum.
Well, exactly. What do you think could possibly be the reasoning behind the I don't know what to call it, and the desperation, the shock that some of the people seem to experience when they get at least a version of the truth. What could possibly lie behind that?
Well, quite honestly, I think that what we're dealing with is the presence of one or more other types of intelligences that are here and interacting with humanity on planet Earth. I think that's exactly what is happening. And I think that where they are at is probably so far beyond our ability to deal with that we just don't know how to deal with them. We don't know how to control them. It's a huge shock when, you know, you go through your life thinking that your species is at the top of the food chain or at the top of the hierarchy. And then you discover, no, actually, that's not the case. There are others, whoever, whatever they are, others who are here, who have their own agenda that may be hostile. It may not be hostile, but they're here doing their thing. And I think that's what it comes down to ultimately. I think it's a traumatic shock. There's another thing about this phenomenon that is equally important for us to remember, and that has to do with energy. I think even a 10-year-old child who sees the movement of a disc that can hover indefinitely and then instantly accelerate, well, these things are not using gasoline or petroleum to go from point A to point B. So implicit within the UFO phenomenon is a post-petroleum paradigm for our civilization. And that's another huge, I mean, an absolutely monumentally huge transformation and a threat, clearly, to the structure of power as it exists on planet Earth. So I think ultimately behind this is that this is the most revolutionary subject, the most revolutionary thing going on in our civilization. When I finished AD After Disclosure with my co-author Bryce Zabel, when we tried looking at all of the implications, the social, political, economic implications, and more of revealing this phenomenon to the public, one thing that really became clear to us is that it is incredibly transformative. It just changes everything. And when you realize that, and if you consider that there are some people who have knowledge of the secret, they probably would be very, very nervous about letting that out and seeing, you know, what hell may break loose after that.
Yeah, exactly. How do you see the breakdown here? Let's say if we discuss factions. Of course, much of this is hypothetical, but that's just where we are at this stage, you know, and we'll get into some of the details more later. But are we simply talking about a Earth group keeping secrecy, simply trying to keep the lid on about the subject to remain in power, remain influential, remain... in upper hand due to the energy question and all these things, or and then you have, well, the question is of course where the other presence would be in this equation, where they would post themselves to this, but is that pretty much how you see the breakdown, or is there something more to that?
Right, I see three fundamental players of this whole scenario. First, there are these other beings, and you know, we can try to explore who, what these other beings probably are, at least based on accounts of people who say that they've had interactions with them. But that's one group. I call them others because I don't know for sure that they're extraterrestrial. I don't know for sure that they're from another dimension of reality, whatever that even may be. I don't know for sure that they're not just some long lost breakaway civilization from our ancient past that just figured out a way to live here in secrecy from. I don't know exactly what they are, but that's one group. And then another group are the human elite of our civilization, some of whom, yes, do have knowledge about this. And I've often referred to them as a breakaway civilization. And I would be happy to explain to your listeners what I mean by that. And then the third group is us, the people, the general public who's, you know, pressing our face to the glass, trying to look inside the store and see what's inside there. And, like a little kid trying to get into the candy store.
Oh, man.
But the lights are off and the curtains just cracked open a little bit and we can see little bits here and there. but we ourselves are going through a great transformation now. And I think actually that we are going to be the game changers. But I see that as those are the three fundamentals. And within that, I think that there are different factions. I think that within the deep classified world, there are almost certainly different factions. I think among these other groups, there are seem to be different agendas. When I look at the whole picture, I mean, it's fantastic in a literal sense. When, you know, we try to step outside of our matrix, our constructed reality of what is supposed to be real, you know, whether it's Obama and the NSA and Edward Snowden or tensions in Crimea and Ukraine and so forth. That's our kind of our general narrative.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think there's this other narrative, this clandestine narrative. And the more that I look into it, the more research that I do, the more I'm convinced that it is just utterly fantastic compared with the kind of very mundane reality that we, most of us, live in.
Right. Yeah. Now, tell us more about the breakaway civilization, the human secrecy faction here trying to, there are a couple of, you know, different possibilities here. They're trying to get off planet for some reason. Yeah. There's a potentiality that they have taken it upon themselves to actually protect the Earth, might actually be a threat out there of some kind. And this is the reason for the secrecy and the massive amounts of money and being poured into this. I guess there are a couple of other possibilities there too, but how do you see the role of the breakaway civilization in this?
Yeah, I would love to talk about it. It might be useful for me very briefly to preface that by explaining just why I am quite convinced that this phenomenon is real. It is not fiction, fictitious, it's not fantastical. It's real. And it just might be useful for listeners to know that my own background as a historian of this phenomenon is to look at declassified U.S. government military documents, primarily, that we have access to. And just in a quick thumbnail sketch, I mean, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond, but particularly in those early years where we do have good access to some of those reports, it is very obvious that U.S. military hierarchy and the intelligence community hierarchy were absolutely concerned and deeply concerned over these objects, which had extraordinary capability, which were invading sensitive airspace and showing particular interest, by the way, in America's nuclear technology, having the ability to go at speeds that were well beyond anything we could go at, having the ability to zigzag and stop instantly and take off instantly, all of these non-inertial types of movements that our propulsion technology, we just were not anywhere close to that. As far as anyone can tell. So there is this nice cache of documentary evidence showing A, that there's something real, and B, that there is a tremendous amount of concern on it in the classified world. So that I take as a given.
Yeah.
Now, relating to a breakaway civilization, well, I'll tell you a conversation I had a number of years ago with a scientist who worked as a civilian with the NSA back in the early and mid-1960s. This is a man who is famous. He's a very, very prominent physicist, brilliant man. And explained to me that circa 1964, 65, the NSA was running computers with a clock speed that he knew of 650 megahertz, which today that's nothing. I mean, that's, you know, you wouldn't want a computer that slow. But in 1965, that was very, very fast. And in fact, in 1965, there were no personal computers anywhere. And it was not a speed that was matched by the consumer market until around the year 2000, so about 35 years later. So on that metric, on that basis, you could argue that the NSA was 35 years ahead of the rest of most of the world in computing. And what makes that even more extraordinary is that in 1964, the NSA was still an unknown agency. It was only outed officially that year in a book. So you have a secret organization with probably the best computing in the world. And I mean, that alone is a fascinating little tidbit of our history. But so going on the basis that, you know, in many ways, the classified world is very, very far ahead of the rest of us in many ways. And then let's take a look at some other journalistic bits of research that have come out over the years. There was a journalist named James Goodall back in the 1980s, early and mid-1980s, who cultivated contacts in Groom Lake, Nevada, which is where Area 51 is, who, and a number of these, said to him explicitly that we have technology in the Nevada desert that, quote, would make George Lucas envious, better than Star Trek, Star Wars, or anything you can imagine in the movies. That's a direct quote. There's a number of these. Now, if it's just one or two of these that come out, you might find a way to dismiss it, but there's actually quite a few of these. So I think there's something going on. So again, back to a breakaway civilization. Let's look at our scenario. You've got acquired exotic technology starting not later than the 1940s, perhaps earlier. There are some stories that even in the 1930s in Germany, they may have acquired something. That may be so.
Yeah.
But certainly by the 1940s, you've got this, you're studying it, you make some monetary breakthroughs, you develop integrated circuits, you develop fiber optics, right? Lasers, who knows? So all of that's great, and all of that reduces to less than zero your incentive for revealing this goose that lays golden eggs. But what if, on the basis of this research, you go even farther? You develop a form of electrogravitics, that is a kind of anti-gravity propulsion system. That's really what electrogravitics is about. And electrogravitics seems to be a viable study, despite what the Wikipedia entry says about it. The wiki entry is actually comically bad. But
like most things there.
Oh, yeah. Wiki is great if you want to find the latest on Justin Timberlake or Miley Cyrus. It's awesome for that.
Exactly. I
highly recommend it. but if you want something on electrogravitics or the true fringe, the true things that matter in this world, don't count on it. But electrogravitics, I think, was a genuine breakthrough. And if that were a breakthrough in the 1950s and 60s, as it looks to me that it was, well, I mean, this is something that could not ever possibly be shared with the rest of the world, because that's a breakthrough that would actually take down the petroleum industry. It would replace the internal combustion engine with something vastly beyond, and incidentally something that would probably be clean, and also something that might be difficult to monetize as easily as petroleum. So if that were a breakthrough in, let's say, the early 1960s, it would be something that would not be allowed to be shared with the rest of the world. But that doesn't mean that research would stop, obviously, because this is very important. So you continue doing the research, and you classify the patents as well. And there are thousands and thousands of classified patents on advanced technology that are in my country, the U.S., and I'm sure are elsewhere in the world. So that if you were a smart person and you developed your own electrogravitic device or something that really worked, or some kind of free energy or energy harvesting device that would, allow us not to need petroleum, in all likelihood, that's a classified patent. A friend of mine, Dr. Thomas Vallone, who's an expert in electrogravitics, worked at the U.S. Patent Office for many, many years, and that is exactly what he said is the case. You've got all these classified patents. So within the classified world, they've got breakthrough in electrogravitics. They've got breakthrough, very likely, in energy harvesting and the like. They're allowed to proceed and continue that research. We're not. So would they? Here's a question. Would they be able at some point to develop their own truly functioning, well, flying saucer? Crazy as that sounds. I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is definitely yes. And I'd be happy to tell you why. But if they've done that, that means, well, they would have the ability to do a whole range of things that the rest of us earthbound entities would not be able to do, like go off world, like explore, like, I mean, go to the moon, go to Mars.
Yeah.
I know all of these things sound just so far beyond what is acceptable in our reality, but I don't think it is out of bounds. I think that's actually what they're doing. So if they're able to do that, they have a vastly different level of technological expertise. They have different interactions with the universe, literally. Do they have interactions with these other beings in one way or another because of that technology? It very well could be yes. They would have a different cosmology, a different understanding of themselves in the grand scheme of things. To me, I look at that as a separate civilization, one that has broken away from our own, hence a breakaway civilization, and that is the concept. And I think that is exactly what's going on. No, we don't have an admission from President Barack Obama that is the case, but I think that is exactly what's happened.
Now, clarify one point, that the group, did they sequester this technology from the others or self-developed, let's say, after a crash-type incident and going from there?
Yeah. There seems to be a number of incidences where something went down that we recovered. And by we, I mean that loosely, as the U.S. Military and probably the Russian military. I just had a recent conversation with a Russian-speaking man who's a researcher in this, and there definitely are a number of cases where the Soviets seemed to recover something, but there's not a lot of leaks about reverse engineering coming out of there. But I think that they probably have doing their own work. But typically there are, I mean, I'm aware of a number of cases where UFOs have come down in different parts of the world where U.S. military seems to pounce right on it. So they've got a system in place and they get there fast. So they've got that, and any new technology they get, I'm sure they want to look at carefully. But also I think it's a situation where once you gain an insight into a certain new science, whether it's electrogravitics, whether it's a form of free energy, then that allows you to make your own breakthroughs. You don't necessarily have to work off of the aliens and what they're doing all the time. You know, your science can take you in whatever directions you want it to go. So I think it's a combination of things. I do think ultimately, you know, our civilization would have gotten to the point where we're at now. I think the acquisition of that exotic technology simply speeded things up a bit.
Now, a lot of questions I have about that. We can discuss more about this. Is it the downed crafts? Is this, do you think, due to conflict, you know, actually shooting at these things and taking them down, or due to something else unknown?
I wish I had the answer to that, Henrik. I don't know. I don't really know anyone who truly knows. There have been a number of cases in the 1950s where we know there were shoot down orders in effect by the U.S. military. I've never really gotten a clear idea that those shoot down orders resulted directly in the downing of an alien craft. But I do know, based on, very good documentary evidence, that some of these things have come down, and that we've been very interested in acquiring them. So how that's happened, I mean, to me, that's an unknown. That's something that I'd like to learn.
Yeah, me too. Is travel to other stars, et cetera, possible with the technology that they have? Or are we talking about mainly exploration of our own solar system first? What does this technology actually allow them to do, do you think?
Well, I'll relate two stories to you. And I think the answer is yes to both, actually. One is a story, and I place high credence in this, of the 1988 account of the ARV, Alien Reproduction Vehicle. And this is an account given by an aerospace executive, an aviation executive named Brad Sorensen, who in 1988 went to an air show at Lockheed's Hellendale facility. This is right after George Bush won election in November 1988 as president. Sorensen wanted to take an aviation illustrator buddy of his, Mark McCandlish, along, and McCandlish had a writing deadline to do, and he couldn't go. So instead, Sorensen took a still officially unnamed high-level U.S. defense official with him. It is believed to be someone who is either a Secretary of Defense or an Undersecretary of Defense. One often hears the name of Frank Carlucci frequently in context of this.
Yeah,
it may have been him or not. In any case, they go to this air show, and then the big shot friend of Sorensen says, let's go to the real show, and I can take you there. And they get into a helicopter with some other people, and they go to a Lockheed facility, and it's known as the Big Hangar, at their Hellendale facility. And in this big hangar are guys with M16s guarding it, and the powerful friend says, ooh, didn't realize it was going to be this intense. Just don't say a word, and I'll get you in. So they get in, and this is an enormous hangar with a huge curtain dividing it. And on one side of it are some very, very advanced U.S. technology. The losing bid to the stealth fighter is in there, and a number of other very, very exotic and interesting aircraft are there. Behind the curtain, Sorensen got a look. And as he said to a number of interviewers, like his brain turned on to high recording gear. And what he saw were three discs. Small, medium, and large. They called it Baby Bear, Mama Bear, and Papa Bear, I think were the nicknames. And all three were hovering. And he said, you know, I looked for cables suspending them. I looked for everything holding them up, and there was nothing there. They were just literally suspended there. He got a very good look at them. McCandlish, after Sorensen described them, drew it out with what appears to be a high level of accuracy. And there was a four-star general at a podium discussing them, and he talked about them as the alien reproduction vehicles. These were our attempts to reproduce alien technology. And according to this general, they had traversed the solar system. They had explored. Sorensen said when he was looking at them, they seemed like they'd been beaten up. They'd been around the block a few times, and they did not look brand new. So that, and then there was a video display that had one of these craft, or something that looked exactly like one of these craft, over a dry desert lake, and lift up and then zoom off. So for what it's worth, I can tell you that I personally know a number of the people who interviewed Brad Sorensen. One of them was the late Gordon Novell. One of them is Dr. Hal Puthoff. I know Hal Puthoff, and I knew Gordon Novell. Talked with both of them about their interview of Brad Sorensen. So I think that's a real story. I think it really happened. Relating to traveling to the stars, we have a statement by Ben Rich. I referred to Ben Rich a little earlier in this conversation. Ben Rich, shortly before his death in the early 1990s, he was head of Lockheed's Skunk Works division. He was the guy in charge of the development of the F-117 stealth fighter. You know, really important stuff. Rich was giving a talk at the UCLA School of Engineering alumni event, and was giving a basic rundown of the history of Lockheed, and then ended his lecture with the statement, "We now know how to travel to the stars." I'm trying to think of the exact, I'm thinking,
yeah,
of
something like that.
We now have the technology to take ET home.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it was, yeah. And then he said, thank you. And you know, like a lot of people don't have a curious bone in their body, so most of them filed out.
Isn't that amazing? Like, what are these journalists, so-called journalists, thinking? Like, excuse me? Can you clarify that a bit?
We live in a zombie nation, man. It's just it's shocking to me. But there were a few people who did stay behind. And they surrounded Ben Rich, you know, and they're peppering him with questions. One of them was Jan Harzan, who's currently the head of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network.
Right.
And I've chatted with Jan about this a number of times. And Rich answered a bunch of questions. And one of the follow-ups was, he said, we now have the technology to take ET home, and it won't take a lifetime to do it. That is to, he said, we now can travel to the stars.
That's right.
And it won't take a lifetime to do it. Right. He said, there was an error in the math, and we've found the error, and we now know how to travel to the stars. So now, he didn't say that we are traveling to the stars. But again, it's another very pregnant type of statement there that I think has a lot of meaning in it. And that's a statement from 1993, so over 20 years ago. It just astonishes me when we think about how much time has now passed where this technology does appear to be absolutely operational. And on top of those stories that I've given you, there have been a number, especially during the late 80s, early 90s, when it was possible to get a look-see at Area 51 before they kind of pushed the boundaries further back for viewers. And also what's known as the Antelope Valley in Eastern California desert there, where you've got a lot of major aviation aerospace companies, Grumman, McDonnell Douglas, Northrop, and so on. And, you know, you have many, many accounts of witnesses seeing what certainly appear to be our craft. And this is, again, more than 20 years ago, performing maneuvers that are just, you know, out of this world. Hovering, instant acceleration, black triangles that are not supposed to exist, but there they are. So there's clearly a very, very advanced aerospace program going on, which I think is part of a secret space program. It's part of a secret infrastructure that has now been, you know, clandestine for many, many decades.
Ben Rich from Lockheed's Skunk Works, when he makes a statement like this, do you think that he's speaking just on behalf of the private company, you know, Lockheed Martin, or is he, I guess I'm trying to get closer to what he's getting at and why he's even saying this, you know, at all?
Yeah. Well, Rich, in 1993, he only lived about a year and a half after that. He died in the very beginning of 1995. He had cancer. the impression that I've always had from this is that he wasn't really expecting to get into this whole thing. I mean, most of his lecture was a very standard, straight up conventional history of Lockheed, what he was able to tell to a public audience. But you know what happens with a lot of these people, you get them privately, and if they're in the right frame of mind, they, you know, the right mood, whatever, sometimes you do get more. I think this happened, by the way, a little over a year ago with the Russian Prime Minister Medvedev, when he was right. talking to a journalist about about the UFO situation and so-called Men in Black. And I actually think that, I mean, I haven't spoken with him. I don't know the man, but I think he was also being, I think he was, he'd let his guard down. And I think this is what happened with Ben Rich. I think he let his guard down for a little while. He might have just said, oh, the hell with it. I'm just going to say it. And he said a little bit, and there you go. So it gets out there. If Lockheed has the technology to do that, that means the U.S. government does. I mean, Lockheed is you know, year in, year out, one of the top contractors to the U.S. government, to the U.S. military.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that technology exists. And I think, again, this is more evidence that we've got this absolutely off-the-charts type of technology that has been developed. And, you know, again, when you think about this petroleum-dominated world in which we live, which is really the primary cause or factor instigator in nearly all of the wars that we are having, certainly one of the key factors, when you see that it's one of the, it's the key factor in the creation of an infrastructure of human civilization that I think everyone who looks at it knows this is not sustainable. It is not sustainable. So when you look at all of that and then you see this technology that has been developed and remains secret and illegal for the rest of us to acquire, well, I think most of us would consider that a problem. I certainly do.
See, I want to talk much more about this and the connected issues in the second hour. But before we break for the first segment here, tell us a little bit about the upcoming conference as well. Are you going to focus pretty much on the same area? I mean, with so much to focus on, what direction are you going to go on this one?
Yeah, this is, I'm really looking forward to this. This is in San Mateo, California, the very last weekend of June, June 28th, 29th, 30th. It's a secret space program, breakaway civilization conference. There's a lot of other researchers who are also, like myself, exploring the real cutting edge of what is the actual true paradigm, the true situation in our world relating to this whole scenario. My own talk, I'm actually in the process of wrapping it up and formulating it and getting it ready for the group, but I will continue my own exploration into how I think the true secret space program is structured, what I think its goals are, why I think it is still secret, and also looking at the energy aspect of this paradigm too, I think is very significant, and how what I think are breakthroughs in energy, you know, and why I think our own civilization, the white world, the non-black world part of it, is primed in the next decade or two to make its own breakthrough in energy, and it's going to cause this whole situation to just go upside down.
Well, exactly. It's going to be a really good event, I think. There's going to be a lot of good speakers, yourself there, of course. I want to mention a few here. Catherine Austin Fitz, Joseph P. Farrell, Carol Rosen, John Rappaport, Michael Schratt, Robert Morningstar, and of course, Mark McCandlish, that you mentioned previously as well. We've had, we'll have all of these people on the radio program as well, so you guys can get a little tidbit of some of the stuff we'll be getting into. But and I'll be there. I'm going to host the conference as well, so it's going to be a lot of fun for me. I hope we'll see you guys there, of course. And if you want to read more and grab tickets and check out the schedule and everything else, the website for that is secretspaceprogram.org. And I also want to mention, by the way, to our members, to check out the discount ticket coupon that we have for you guys there on our members website, redicemembers.com. Okay, shortly here, before we take a break again, tell us more about the book, where we can pick up the copy of your latest, and give us your website and everything else we need to know to read more about your work, Richard.
Yes, my new book is called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, and it's available at my website, richarddolanpress.com. I write UFO books, or I write books related to that subject, and I also publish books related to that subject. And at that website, you can see my book, and as well as books by some other really interesting authors whose work I've decided I really want to get out there. So that's all there. The book is available as a printed book and as an ebook, so you can get it either way. Ebook's got a lot of really neat links embedded in it, so it makes it a little more of a fun read if you've got a nice e-reader. I set that up myself, and I'm getting better and better at setting up ebooks. I'm proud of that. you can check it out there. And it's a book that really covers, again, the whole gamut of the UFO phenomenon, the politics, the encounters. I mean, really everything I felt was important.
Very good. UFOs for the 21st century mind. There's a lot of other interesting aspects in the book that I want to get into more in the second as well. In the meantime, RichardDolanPress.com. Stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Richard, and we'll be right back after the break.